Well, let's get started. We're a little bit late already. Gracious God, we thank you for this day, for this opportunity to come together as your people, to study your word, to be in thought and prayer about those who have had unfortunate incidents that have happened lately, those who need healing, those who are grieving. Lord, we ask that you would be with all of your children this night. Watch over them and care for them. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, I promised you last week we were going to watch the next section of this video. Each section of this video covers four chapters. And we're kind of in the middle of chapters 1 to 4. So we will watch we will watch
are you close to that?
No, try to readjust the contrast a little for me.
Yeah, I'm working on that part, Jeff.
We saw in our first time together that one of the most popular ways to read Revelation is actually to create a theological system using Revelation. Much of the popular literature that you find about Revelation combines parts of that book with portions of other sections of the scriptures in order to create a scenario of the future. We decided that a way to proceed, a different way, would be to read Revelation as a book with its own integrity, to take Revelation as a book from chapter 1 through chapter 22, and to see what Revelation would sound like if we actually looked at it as a whole. When we begin in chapter 1 with Revelation, we find right away in the first verse that Revelation identifies its author, that it was a message that was sent from God to a man named John. Now people wonder who was John, and we've actually got more speculation than we do hard evidence about who John was. Early Christian tradition had identified John as one of Jesus' 12 disciples, someone who had been called by Jesus, who had followed him through his ministry in Galilee and in Jerusalem. Now what's interesting is when you read Revelation, John never claims to have been one of Jesus' original disciples, nor does John even claim to have seen Jesus during his ministry on earth. The only thing that John will tell us about himself is that he was a Christian, that he was on the island called Patmos off the coast of what today is Turkey. In the ancient times it was Asia Minor. And that he was a Christian who was bearing witness to Jesus Christ. John never claims to be an apostle, never claims to have been with Jesus in Galilee or Jerusalem. And so I think we do well simply to stay with what Revelation actually gives us. The indication that it was written by a man named John, about whom we know very little else. Now when we get into the book of Revelation, just a few more verses, we'll find that one of the best kept secrets about Revelation is that Revelation is a letter. In chapter 1, verse 4, we read the words, John to the seven churches that are in Asia. Now those same words recall the kinds of openings that you find in many of the other letters that are in the New Testament. In the beginning of Romans, Paul wrote to the church at Rome. At the beginning of 1 Corinthians, Paul wrote to the church at Corinth. In Philippians, Paul addresses his letter to the church at Philippi. John, in the book of Revelation, says John to the seven churches that are in Asia. Recognizing that Revelation is a letter, I think is one of the best kept secrets about the book. People oftentimes put it off in a separate category, as if it's some strange and mysterious kind of literature that no one can possibly understand. But when you think about how you read letters are a form of communication. They're designed to bring a message to people living in time and space. Paul wrote to Rome in order to be understood by them. John wrote to the seven churches in Asia in order to be understood by them. Revelation is a form of communication. It's designed to bring a message that would actually have meaning for people in living, breathing congregations. People who wanted to know something about what God's will for them was. Now, with that in mind, we can read a little bit further and we'll find something about the setting in which this communication took place, in which John was trying to bring a message to these seven congregations. In Revelation chapter 1, verse 9, John writes, "I, John, your brother, who shared with you in Jesus the persecution and the kingdom and the patient endurance, was on the island called Patmos because of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet saying, 'Write in a book what you see, and send it to the seven churches.'" You'll note that after John gets this word, he's told which seven churches the message was supposed to go to. In other words, he's told what to put on the outside of the envelope. He's told the postal route to make sure that there's no question about who's supposed to be reading this. The seven churches listed there are Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. A group of seven congregations in seven cities in Western Asia, what today is modern Turkey. Now, if we take John seriously, we'll take it seriously that he really does intend to communicate. Our task is not to take Revelation less seriously than those who speculate about the end times, but to take it more seriously, and to take it seriously when John says that he intends to communicate with people. Now, when you turn to Revelation chapter 2 and 3, you'll find that John will take us through a tour of these seven churches, so that what we find in Revelation chapter 2 and 3 is really an opportunity to get to know some of these people. What was going on in their lives? What were the challenges that were facing them in their faith? Now, there are seven churches, and that each one has a somewhat different situation, but they do fall into several kinds of categories. When people do take Revelation's context seriously, they often assume that Revelation was a book that was written for Christians undergoing hardship or persecution. And that is true to a limited extent. You do find that there were Christians in these churches who were being persecuted for their faith. Smyrna is a good example. What's going on at Smyrna is a form of persecution in which Christians are apparently being denounced before the authorities who were in a position to put them into prison. If they were in prison, they also faced the possibility of potential death if they didn't renounce their faith. Now, this gives us a little bit of a glimpse into what was going on in a context. Christians were denounced for their faith because they really didn't fit in very well. They didn't worship the same gods and goddesses that everyone else did. There was plenty of religion in the ancient world. It wasn't a secular society. People could worship Zeus or Dionysus, Aphrodite or Artemis. There were plenty of gods and goddesses to go around. And Christians said, "Fine, but we don't worship any of them. We confess the one true God." Because they didn't worship as others worshiped, they were considered to be outsiders, strange. And so sometimes measures were taken to force them into conformity. And that was what was going on in the church at Smyrna, and to some extent at the church in Philadelphia. But there are still other congregations that had rather different kinds of problems. A second category of problems were assimilation. You find in the message to Pergamum, which follows in Revelation chapter 2, that the church at Pergamum was facing a situation in which some people were teaching that it was acceptable to eat meat sacrificed to idols. Now, that's a strange kind of issue for most of us living in the 21st century. Most of us don't worry about what it might mean to eat meat offered to idols. But for Christians back in John's time, that was a boundary issue. was an issue that had to do with how much does your faith set you apart from other people in your society. People might eat meat offered to idols at any number of different occasions. Probably the easiest to imagine is an occasion in which there is a public festival, a celebration. The whole town would turn out, much as they do during celebrations that we have in our cities today. There would be a civic celebration in which you would get the leaders of the town who would come out. There would be a parade. It would all end up with a great sacrifice in the center of town and a free distribution of meat to everyone who came. People wanted to participate. Citizens of Pergamum would want to turn out to be part of it because everybody was doing it. Everybody was there. To be a citizen of the town was to participate in the worship of Zeus. But could Christians really do that without compromising their faith? It was a boundary issue, made Christians uncomfortable. The issue of how much does your faith set you apart was a problem for Christians in Pergamum and Thyatira, as well as in Ephesus. The final category is one of complacency. Toward the end of chapter 3, you find the church at Laodicea, and that there the risen Christ says to them that they see themselves as rich, prosperous, they need nothing. They're called lukewarm because they're so comfortable that there's no edge, no vitality left in their faith. For them, the problem is not that life is so bad. The problem for them is that life is too good, too easy. And because they were so comfortable, they were falling asleep in their faith. There was no edge, no vitality left. There are several different kinds of problems then. Revelation isn't written for just one kind of reader. It's written for Christians who are feeling afflicted in their faith. It's written for Christians who are trying to keep their faith under wraps, not let it show, not interfere with their social life. And it's written for people who are just so comfortable that there's no vitality left in their faith. If Revelation can address a group of Christians that diverse in its own time, I'm convinced that it can continue to address Christians as diverse as those of us who are living today. Now, as we make our way forward, we'll find that when John takes us into chapter 4, the question is not so much, where are you coming from? Are you coming from a situation in which you're comfortable or afflicted or somewhere in between? Because what John is interested in is not where you're coming from, but where are you coming to? In chapter 4, we find a vivid description of God seated on the throne, surrounded by a host of elders and a group of creatures who are engaged in heavenly praise. They sing out, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty," and in so doing invite those of us who are reading the book to join with them in heavenly praise. The vision of God seated on the throne in Revelation chapter 4 is where Revelation wants to draw us to. Out of our situations, whether we're comfortable or complacent, whether we're afflicted or just trying to get along, it tries to catch us up in that same vision of praise and celebration. Many of our hymn writers have set these things to music. Hymns like "Holy, Holy, Holy" are precisely musical renditions of Revelation 4. As we proceed, some questions to think about. Where do you see some of the churches like those in Revelation 2 and 3 today? Where do you see Christians being persecuted for their faith? Where might you see Christians who are just trying to blend in, not let their faith interfere with their social life? Where might you see Christians who are simply so comfortable, so affluent, that there's no vitality left in their faith? As you think about where you see Christians like that, think about where you see yourself. And then in light of Revelation chapter 4 and the vision of the heavenly throne room, ask yourself, where might God be calling you today?
Okay. So the challenge of persecution, assimilation, and complacency. Are those things that the modern church faces? Big time. And I know I've told you the story of my friend in Indonesia who
right after the attacks on the Christian churches at Christmas Eve, was asking me to try and help him find a job over here within Siemens, because he was afraid to stay there because he and his family were Christian. And one of the churches that was bombed that Christmas Eve was the one that they normally attended, but they'd gone to visit her parents, and so were not at church that night. But they had many friends who were there.
We don't have that problem in this country. We don't have that kind of problem in this country, as I'm aware of.
Not as directly.
Not yet.
Not as directly. There is persecution. There is persecution, depending on who you are. For predominantly white, middle-level American churches, no. Not for the most part. But not that many years ago, if you were a small black congregation, especially in the South,
yeah,
you were persecuted. If you tried to go to a white church, I mean, what would have happened? We have had kinds of persecution, not a overall, against Christianity in its total, but against certain segments of Christians. Yes, we have had that kind of persecution.
What was 9/11?
Conspiracy.
9/11, if you believe the rhetoric, that was between the Muslims and the Jews. Had nothing to do with Christians.
Oh, yeah.
Because,
I would never believe that.
No.
Who owned all the buildings? Who owned those buildings?
They
were all owned by Jewish families.
The rhetoric I heard was all non-believers.
Well,
exactly. Whether you're
Christian, everybody but them.
Yep.
It doesn't matter.
But the target was the World Trade Center because of its importance, its size, its location, and because it was Jewish owned. So all of those things.
They also targeted the Pentagon.
Sure. Well, I mean, if you want to target the military in this country, where do you target? On the East Coast. Pentagon. Yeah. I mean, that made sense. The one that was headed for Philadelphia, that one didn't make a lot of sense to me.
That was supposed to go to
White House.
Well, they said it was going to come around, yeah, but
I have a lot of Muslim customers. Matter of fact, half of my customers are Muslim, and I'll tell you right now, it's non-believers. They don't care if you're Jewish. They don't care if you're Christian. They don't care if you're an atheist. You don't believe. It's it.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what religion.
Yeah. Well, and that's not true for all Muslims either.
Yeah, but we're making excuses. So
there's another part of that.
I think, they need to be held accountable a lot more than what,
sure.
Where's all the killings done? Yeah. They're the ones doing it. And then if there's all these moderate Muslims, why aren't they stepping up? They're silent.
Well, they're not silent. And they are speaking out. But they're speaking out as pacifist. It would be like attacking the Amish. What are they going to do? They're going to speak out, but they're going to speak out as pacifist.
But you see, the Quran also tells them that all non-believers. There's a whole last I forget what they call it, the last canon in their book. All non-believers. You can say what you want to them. It can tell you, oh no, I'm really sorry. As long as you're a non-believer, they can tell you anything you want to know. Lying is not a problem. It's not a problem to a non-believer.
Well, I mean,
now, as a believer, you have to be honest.
And Christians have done the same thing.
Yeah, but we don't have a book that says that.
Sure we do.
Where?
Bible.
Where does it say?
Where does it say it's okay to lie?
Look
at the Crusades and look at the things that were done in the name of Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Where does it say it in the Bible?
Well, it says wherever you want it to. If you twist it enough, the same is true of the Quran.
No. There's no words in the Bible that say that.
Sure there are.
To go kill Muslims?
Paul says it. Paul says, distance yourselves from those who don't believe.
That's different.
Distance didn't say distance.
Well, it depends on how
they go out and kill.
It depends.
Be hit, smite them above the shoulder.
It depends on how you interpret it. And Christians at the time of the Crusades said, "They're not Christians. Convert or die."
Or Spanish Inquisition. All that
Spanish Inquisition. This is not new. Now, I don't like it. None of us do. But it's not new. Christianity did the same thing.
Yes, it did.
Don't ever let anybody tell you they didn't. The atrocities committed by the Christians at the time of the Crusades are every bit as bad as what's happening today.
Absolutely.
They just didn't have as good of weapons. So it was a smaller scale. But you read the stories of the Crusades, and we have a lot to be ashamed of from that. But
guess what?
That was almost 800 years ago.
Sure it was.
But guess what? There's nothing in the Bible.
We did the same thing all over this country less than 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hadn't been that long.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. One of the things I was reading tonight, N.T. Wright, in talking about these cities and the things going on, talks about the War of the Roses in England, which was Yorkshire and Lancaster, and talks about how still today, several hundred years later, there's still animosity there. Well, gee, move south of the Mason-Dixon line and tell somebody how much better it is up north. What happens? Exactly.
Next thing we know, that's right. Planes in the
well, I mean,
come on, it's not even close.
But you know, I mean, you're right. I mean, we even during the Civil War, some of those same things happened.
The bad part about the Civil War is actually still going on because human slavery trade.
Oh yeah.
Is second to drugs in this country.
That's right. That's right. And again, go back to World War II, World War I. I mean, what Hitler did, you know how Hitler got away with it, is he looked at the German Lutherans and said, "Hey, this is what Luther wrote about the Jews. I'm just going to make what Luther wanted to happen, happen." And they said, "Oh, well, that must be okay then." It is. That's why at the World Federation of the Lutheran World Federation a couple years ago, they had this long debate and they issued a formal apology to all Jews in the world for the misuse of Luther's writings and what Hitler did with them.
I mean, well, Hitler was crazy though. Yeah.
But everybody let him get away. So
crazy smart.
Read Bill O'Reilly's book, Killing Patton.
Yeah. Well, they had one good one. Eric, I can't remember his last name.
He was on another flight, but he wasn't. Maybe I
should have said that.
Eric.
Oh, there were several.
He saved so many.
Oh, there were several. There were several Lutherans who stood up to Luther, and most of them died for it. Bonhoeffer is a great
Bonhoeffer,
one. But yeah, there were several Lutheran pastors who said, "No, this is wrong." The Barman Declaration was Lutheran and Reformed pastors who wrote a document standing and saying that Hitler was wrong, that he was interpreting Luther incorrectly. And that what he was doing was wrong and that the church needed to stand up to him. And most of the people who signed that document died.
The Jews just happened to be the largest group to be persecuted.
They were the richest. He was after their money. I mean, the Third Reich took a lot of cash to keep going.
And art.
And so, yeah, the money, the artwork, all that stuff. I mean, yeah, I mean, Hitler would have made a great Wall Street banker.
But that wasn't part of the plan, or God would let him annihilate all of them.
Yeah, well, you're right. But these are things that have happened more recently.
And he had Jew in his background, too, ironically enough.
Well, we all know about the Germans, but the Japanese did an even bigger job.
Oh, man.
They went through China.
Yeah, that was a whole other.
And the sad part is,
Now you talk about making deals with the devil. That's what Hitler did with Japan.
Yeah.
And really, that was his downfall.
That's what Roosevelt did with Stalin.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
That too. But you know, as they say, politics makes strange bedfellows. You. Yeah, isn't that weird? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, look back over the last 50 years. I mean, things we all know about. Look at Iraq.
Yeah.
Gee, how did Saddam Hussein get some of the stuff he had? Duh, we gave it to him. We gave it to him.
Because
he was fighting another enemy of ours. Yeah. Exactly.
During World War II, the Iranians were really, they were called Persians then, sorry. They were real friendly with Adolf Hitler. He loved the idea of going after the Jews.
Oh, yeah.
They loved that idea.
Sure they did. Yeah, you know, and in fact,
still do.
Yeah, and I think if you go back and look at some of the tactics being used today, I imagine if you were a historian enough to be able to look at what ISIS, for example, is doing, and look at what Hitler did, you probably see a lot of similarities in tactics and the way they're doing things.
Did he ever chop people's heads off?
Yeah,
he just killed them. That's all.
Well,
yeah,
it's. Yeah, I mean, you know,
somebody's head off is unbelievable.
Yeah, well. Yeah. All right. So, did we finish Smyrna last week? We were talking about Smyrna, chapter 2, verses 8 to 11.
Yeah.
We talked about Smyrna.
I think that's where we stopped.
Yeah, we talked about the second day.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's why I'm interested in that number.
All right.
You're not no cat.
Well, let's talk about Pergamum then. Oh, and by the way, I did find my book, and Ignatius wrote not to all the same seven churches, but close. He wrote to the Ephesians. He wrote to the Magnesians. I don't know who they were. The Trallians, the Romans, the Philadelphians, the Smyrnans, and then to a letter to Bishop Polycarp, who was the Bishop of Smyrna. So Ignatius wrote to some of the same churches, not exactly the same. I told you I was not sure about that, but... Ignatius was the bishop of Antioch, who was arrested for his crimes against the Roman Empire, basically telling people not to bow down to Caesar. And as he was being led from Antioch to Rome, he wrote these seven letters, and we have those. Those were preserved for us and translated into English from the Greek. And they make for interesting reading. But anyway, he wrote to some similar churches, but not the exact same ones. Okay, the letter to Pergamum. Write this to the angel of the church in Pergamum. These are the words of the one who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know where you live. Have you ever heard that before? I know where you live. I know where you live, right there where the Satan has his throne. You have clung on to my name and have not denied my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed in your midst in the dwelling place of the Satan. But I do have a few things against you, for some people there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who instructed Balak to cause the children of Israel to stumble, making them eat idol food and indulge in sexual immorality. So, too, you have some among you who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans, So repent. If you don't, I will come to you quickly, and you will fight against them with the sword of, and will fight against them with the sword in my mouth. Let anyone who has an ear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. To anyone who conquers, I will give secret manna and a white stone with a new name written on that stone, which nobody knows except the one who receives it. So what do you hear there?
Like a threat. Sounds like a threat.
Yeah, very much.
Is it his threat or is it God's threat?
Well, I mean, he's writing what Jesus told him to write.
But is he writing for it? Because it's a dream that he's interpreting here. Mm-hmm.
So, do you remember the story, King Balak of Moab, who hired the prophet Balaam to curse Israel? It's in Numbers 20, chapters 22 to 24, if you need to go reread that sometime. Balaam found he couldn't curse them. He was, to that extent, a true prophet, but he still wanted the reward he'd been promised, so he encouraged the king to a different tactic. And what he did was they sent out women to seduce the Israelites. And in doing so, instead of getting money from them or favor from them, it was, oh, well, come to the temple with me. Yeah. And one of the things we know from history, and Paul writes about it, is the fact that there were temple prophets. Not temple prophets. There were temple prostitutes that were, it was very common. So if, you know, well, it's like, yeah, come on down to the club for lunch. And stay a while. Well, in this case, it was the temple. And it was not the Jewish temple, not the Christian temple. It was the temple to somebody else. And they had good food. And it was free as long as you stayed for worship. And it was even freer if you participated in other activities. But it was the kind of temptations that were used to lure faithful people away from the one true God. So what we're being told by John here is that this is the kind of thing that seemed to be happening in other places. There were temptations of, as Craig Kester said, there were various temptations. There were people who were saying, well, you know, it's okay if we do this. It's okay if we do this. It won't hurt our faith. And the reality is, of course, it does. It does. Anything like that you can think of today?
Politics.
Well, yeah.
Politics, very much.
Politics, I think, yeah, is a great one. And again, politicians who say things in the name of Christianity that are about as far as from what Jesus would have done as anything I can think of. Yeah, we certainly have that.
Like you think preachers did.
Sometimes. Yeah. I think televangelists are like that. And I don't necessarily mean 100% across the board, but many of them, they're really only there for one reason, and it's not to save your soul. And as you know, they can't do that anyway.
That's what I've heard. When some of them have like $475 million,
Yeah.
And they got to a point that Jesus is not saving you anymore. I am.
Sure. Now, I've read a lot of stuff that Rick Warren wrote, and his stuff isn't all bad. But one thing that I just choked on when I read it was Rick Warren, in an interview, said, "My job here on earth is to save as many souls for Jesus as I can." And I'm like, what? You're going to climb up on a cross? Okay. There's no other way to do it. How else are you going to do that? But he truly believes that he was sent to earth to save souls. It's like, no. God sent his son so that we might have everlasting life. Not Rick Warren. Not John Hagee. Not even Billy Graham. Although I've never heard Billy Graham say that.
Now, Reverend Ike? You never hear Reverend Ike?
And don't hear me wrong either. Some of these televangelists have done some really good things. What's his name? The big black guy who started Promise Keepers. He's gotten in some trouble here lately. Reverend Jake something. When he first got started, one of the things he was fundamental in was starting Promise Keepers. You ever heard of Promise Keepers?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Promise Keepers, particularly in the black community, has done some great stuff. It has helped men who were not being fathers to their children learn to stand up and do that. That's what Promise Keepers is about. And so that's a really good program. But Jake, like so many televangelists, you know, the money just kind of went to his head and he thought he could get away with anything. And right now he's got, I forget how many people accusing him of sexual misconduct of various sorts. Several of them with underage girls. But, I mean, the point of being a preacher, whether it's to two people or 2 million people, is to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ, period.
And I think it's, any of them who make a business for their own personal gain out of it is not a true Christian.
This is the problem I have with non-denominational churches in general. It's the same thing as televangelist. If you're in a denomination and they don't agree with you and they want to censor you for what you're doing, or they want to put rules on you about what you and your church might do, how you might preach, what it is you might profess that you believe. Like the Lutheran Church says, we profess the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and the Athanasian Creed. And everything that we teach has to fall within those. And if I teach something that doesn't fall within the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed or the Athanasian Creed, guess what? I get told I'm wrong. But if you want to do something outside of that and you just want to tell the church, well, I just disagree with you, then you go start your own denomination. Whether it's a different brand of Lutheran or whether it's just a non-denominational with no name. We talk about, who was it the other night was telling me, there's currently something like 47 different brands of Baptist, and there's at least that many Lutherans in this country. But how many non-denominationals are there that come out of all of those groups? I mean, there's got to be hundreds.
Our backdoor neighbor calls them all brand churches.
Yeah, really. But I mean, the whole point is like if I want to teach something a little different than what Luther said, then I can go start my own church, and I can do whatever I want. And that's the good and the bad in this country. That's what freedom of religion is all about. You are free to worship in any way you desire. That's what the Constitution guarantees you. The problem for those of us in the church
is that some of those people then pretend to speak for the church, and they don't. When you hear me talk about mainstream Christianity, I talk about those churches who profess the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed. The Athanasian Creed is a little more debatable, but those churches who profess the Nicene Creed and the Apostles' Creed and say that their teachings have to line up with that, we all agree a whole lot, which is one of the reasons why the ELCA has so many churches that we're partners with, full communion partners, where we can trade pastors, because we all say that this is what we believe and we all agree on. Now, if you don't agree with those things and you go off and do your own thing, and especially if you got a good satellite up there and you can start broadcasting to lots of people, even if it is 2:00 in the morning, guess what? You're going to start getting people to hear you. And when you start speaking for the church, a lot of people don't understand that you're not really speaking for the church. You say you are, but you really aren't. And they don't understand why what you're saying is wrong. And so, going back to this, where we've got people be led astray by sometimes very intentional means and sometimes unintentional means. It's just like Paul when he was dealing with the Corinthians, and they had these people who were coming back and teaching that you had to become Jewish before you could become Christian. And Paul's trying to battle that. Well, we've also got people saying, well, if you live in this town, guess what? You got to pray to Zeus or to Apollo or whoever. And if even if you don't, you got to pretend to. Or, you know, it's like you can't get into the country club if you say those things really loud. So just keep it quiet. We'll get you into the country club. That kind of stuff. That's the kind of things that we're hearing about. People being led astray by sometimes big things and sometimes just little things.
I got a question for you. What do you think of Jeremiah Wright?
Don't know much about it.
They call him a reverend. They call himself a reverend. Has a church.
Well, I mean, there are lots of people who do that. And again, see, this is the problem when you're not part of a denomination. Within a denomination...
he's part of a denomination. United Church of Christ.
Is he?
Yes. My sister heard of that. And I was asking her about it.
Yeah. If you're part of a denomination, then that denomination decides what you can call yourself. And if he is UCC,
and
he is calling himself, and he says he is the reverend or whatever, that means he has been ordained and most likely has a Master of Divinity degree. Now, you can get Master of Divinity degrees online, just like you can any degree. And some of them aren't even worth the ink that it takes to print the paper. But... I don't know. I don't know anything about him. I'll be honest with you. I ignore.
Well, that's who our president was influenced by.
Well, somewhat. But they also had a breaking of ways.
Well, yeah. Also had, but, was there 22 years. He was married there. Daughters and children baptized. And,
But
he used it to get influence, you know, become a member of that church for his political gain.
Well... I know a few people in this area who have done that too within Lutheran congregations.
Wow.
But
all I know is
I know a particular salesman who switched from a small Lutheran church to a large Lutheran church because he saw a larger body of people he could sell to.
But when you invite people to the communion table, what do you say? All those who are believers in Christ.
No. This is the meal of the baptized. This is the meal of the baptized.
But all those are welcome. We're believers of Christ.
The Baptists do that.
This is the meal of the baptized.
And you must have changed it lately.
There are no official words in the hymnal. There was a time when, those who believed. That was also at a time when more Lutheran churches practiced a more closed communion. In the ELCA, it has been from day one, which has now been almost 30 years. In the ELCA, it has always been, this is the meal of the baptized. All are welcome.
Do you say that at every communion?
I don't.
I've not heard you say
that. I have printed it in a couple of bulletins, but for the most part, no. If I know we're going to have a lot of outsiders, Christmas Eve I did.
Okay, I don't remember.
But yeah, it is the meal of the baptized. All are welcome. Yes. And that is, come January, that's what I'm hoping we'll be doing as a Bible study. The ELCA has put out a Bible study about the use of the means of grace, primarily because we're finding that there's just a whole lot of people in the ELCA who don't agree on what are our practices, and even though we have a document that describes it. And so we'll be talking about that some, hopefully after Christmas. But yeah, the ELCA, you can look it up online, the use of means and grace. And it very clearly says that communion is the meal of the baptized. There's no minimum age. There are no minimum requirements. It is those who are baptized. Now, to be baptized, you essentially have, someone has said, you or a parent has said that you believe. And in fact, we use the words of the Apostles' Creed as part of baptism.
Well, I've talked to a couple other Lutheran churches, and they always said the same thing.
It's a holdover from the 50s. Yeah, it's a holdover from the 50s, and some churches still do that.
Presbyterian Church, the same thing. All believers in Christ.
Yeah. But the official wording and the use of means of grace is that this is the meal of the baptized, and that's what I tend to put out. I don't believe in age limits. Because I know children who understand it far better than some adults. I know some children who are more reverent of communion than are some adults. And I certainly know some adults, particularly those in nursing homes, who remember that when you hand them a wafer that they dip it in the wine and they put it in their mouth, but they don't remember anything else. Because they don't have the capability. So being able to profess a certain belief is not a requirement for communion. It is a gift of God for all of his baptized children. Let's see. The problem in Pergamum is that much of the church has lost its cutting edge, its ability to say no to the surrounding culture. For these people, Jesus has stern words. We've talked a little bit about the things that they've been giving into, but what does a cutting edge church look like? What does a cutting-edge church look like? What would you think it would look like?
I think some of those churches over in Charlotte. The High Rock Churches. What was that one?
The Revolution.
You're taking cutting-edge a whole different way. You're talking about high technology, and things.
Is it just larger, more popular churches?
Nope. What would a cutting edge church look like that Jesus would be describing?
Oh, that Jesus would be
professes love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Follows his.
Yeah.
Word and preaches his word. Yeah.
A church who's feeding the hungry, building houses for the homeless, a church who is doing work for the poor. Yeah, that would be a kind of cutting-edge church that I think Jesus is talking about. Not one that's got a bigger band or a bigger sound system or a bigger stage. Or those things are, the way in which the message is delivered is irrelevant. I can show you churches that have very formal liturgical worship that are huge and just as big and cutting edge in other ways,
as some of those churches who have got all electronics and big screens and satellite TV coverage and pastors in skinny jeans. And you know, the way the message is delivered is not the issue. Cutting edge in what John is talking about here, what Jesus has told him to tell his church, is how are you living out the Sermon on the Mount? How are you living out the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount? Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the sick in prison, or visit those in prison, visit the sick, tend to the poor. That's the cutting edge Jesus is worried about. And it's not as much what they say or how they say it, it's how they show it.
Taking care of the
churches within the community.
Yeah. Loving your neighbor. That's the cutting edge Jesus is after. And in particular when that's not popular. And right now, what's really unpopular right now, especially if you're a politician? Well, that's one thing.
I said Ebola.
But
I mean, one's died, and a deputy now has got flu-like symptoms. You know, he's under quarantine.
But well, what you're speaking of, gay marriage?
No, homelessness. Homelessness is the biggest issue in this country that no politician wants to touch. Except one.
You don't hear about homelessness when the Democrats are in power. I hate to be political here, but if Republicans are in power, that's all you hear about. Reagan, you know, they tarred and feathered him on homelessness and on Bush.
Well, you know what most Republicans I know of say about homelessness? We need to put an end to it. We need to put them on jail. Our current president is the only person I've heard from a national level address poverty and homelessness.
What has he done? He's created more of it, so he should.
No, yeah. I disagree with you.
Obama is.
You disagree with the facts and figures?
Facts and figures I see show that more jobs have been created in the last 8 years than they have in the last 20.
Yeah, part done. I'm out in the real world. My retailers can tell you.
Look at our state numbers.
All my retailers can tell you.
People working,
they got no money. The black community is starving right now.
Well, lots of people are starving.
No, the black community in particular. The unemployment rate in the black community is real high.
And I disagree with that, too. If you want to see who's starving, come to Mount Zion tomorrow and see who lines up for the piddly little amount of food that gets given out at the Second Harvest Food.
Come with me to Atlanta.
Children.
I'm scared to go to Atlanta.
I can show you.
Children, yeah.
They're all.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's family. It's families with children.
Families with children.
There are more children who go to bed hungry in this country than anywhere in the world. And you know what? We can't blame anyone but ourselves. We can't blame any politician for it. It's not the politicians who have created it. It's not the politicians who have sustained it. It is we, the people.
We, the people, elected those politicians.
No, it has nothing to do with politics.
Obama got reelected.
Nothing to do with politics. If the church stood up and said, we are going to make it a priority to make sure that no child goes to bed hungry, it could happen. But you know what? Even in the churches in Cabarrus County, you can't get agreement on that. Because most of them will say, well, let them go out and work for it. There are any number of good, solid Lutherans who will say, I'm not going to give money to go feed those people. Mm. Now, again, what did Jesus teach in the Sermon on the Mount? That's the cutting edge that John's talking about. Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the sick, care for the poor, house the homeless. That's the church's mandate. Forget politics. That's what the church is mandated to do. How are we doing?
How?
We're not doing very good.
No.
Than other religions.
I don't know.
Well,
I don't have anything to compare against.
Just here, and I'm on the food ministry board, we fed more people in the month of September than we had in a long time. But here at the church, I brought a big thing. It started out being filled, got less and less and less, and I finally took it out because there was nothing in it.
We need to bring it back and need to start pushing it. But things like the fish fry, where we raise money for Mount Pleasant Food Ministry, I mean, that's a good thing. But that's not enough. That's not enough. We can do
how
more.
How many ways can you go by on the days that they, how many cars are sitting there waiting to get in?
Yeah. Well, how many new cars are sitting there? I'm judging.
Yeah.
We all do it there.
Yeah. And you're going to have a certain number of people who take advantage
right.
of
everything. Yeah.
But if they have kids to feed, at least maybe the kids are getting something.
And I don't know what numbers are in Stanley or in Cabarrus County, but I know in Stanley County it's something like 70% or 80% of kids are on free and reduced lunch. And that's not something they just give away. You have to really qualify for that. I know that my wife is on the Stanley County Christian Ministry Board, and they had a meeting yesterday. They're about broke. The demand to them has been so overwhelming. United Way has cut funding for the last 3 years straight. I'm sure they've seen that here. There's been more red tape thrown up about getting access to the government distributed food. It has just become very difficult for those who are trying to feed the hungry.
Well, there's something going on in our society.
Sure,
they're jobs.
Our parents and our grandparents were a lot poorer. We are today.
Sure.
We have no industry.
They did.
Yeah.
They
jobs we're talking
them,
about.
And these people are
hard-time jobs.
Would have the ability. I've worked in the garden and stuff and all, and then you ask people, they want you to give it to them and cook it.
Some of those people don't
like that. They won't come out and work.
Some of those people don't have access to a garden. They don't have access to
tools. They won't do the work.
I think... You know what? Most communities who start community gardens find that there are lots of people who are willing to do it. If someone says, hey, here's some dirt you can plant in, and here's a hoe, and tell you what, I'll even give you some pointers. They don't know how. Gardening is not something that's instinctive to most people. I mean, you know that, Rick. You've gardened your whole life. I have.
Yeah, we can do something like that. You know, I mean, there's people around here. I got a tractor. Buddy's got a tractor. We'd fix the garden spots for them and all like that. But I guarantee you, you wouldn't see them out there in July and August.
Well, the problem is that some of them, I mean, if they don't own where they live, they may be prohibited from putting in a garden. That happens. We've talked about down at St. Martin. There's 100 acres back there behind the church, and about 30 or 40 of it, probably 40 acres, is clear. Now, my understanding is it's got some fill in there. It might have to be bulldozed out and have some a lot of rocks and bricks and stuff pulled out of it. But you could certainly take some portion of that and till it up and make it into usable gardens. They did it in Richfield. I've seen lots of community gardens in other places. Not everyone. But there are people who will come and do it. But it takes two things. It takes a place where they're free to do it. And it takes someone to show them how. Because, a lot of everything I know about gardening, I know from watching my mother and my grandmother. They don't teach you how to grow a garden in school. They didn't back then, and they sure as heck don't now. They don't teach you anything practical in school. That's the kind of thing it takes. It's like the story of teach a man, give a man a fish, and you fed him for a day. Teach him to fish, and he can feed himself for a lifetime.
Now he's got a green thumb. He can bring something.
This parsonage, I think about this, it's sitting empty. But then we all about at one time giving it to someone, or but there is so much red tape that we're responsible for that you can't do anything.
Well, but there are other things you can do. Why not fix it up and use it as a soup kitchen? Or use it as storage for food and do our own food pantry once a month. Or lots of different things.
They still pay farmers not to plant food.
But you know, but the majority of that really comes from the fact that a lot of ground was being overfarmed anyway. You know, if they'd gone back and read the Old Testament about how to farm, they wouldn't have had some of that.
Our foods don't have the nutrition that they used to have.
No.
Our soils have been depleted of a lot of minerals and stuff.
Yeah.
And then we've got these genetically modified seeds that don't have, you know, we don't really know the whole story of what these GMO seeds are going
to
do to our
Which is why I, as much as possible, try and buy heirloom seeds.
You try to, yeah.
And I, you know, my son-in-law's horses fertilize my garden.
It's
something to think about. You know, what is it that the church can do? I'm sure he's not alive anymore, but there was a pastor from Hickory. He was semi-retired. I don't know how long he'd been blind, but for quite some time. But he would come and supply, and his son would have to bring him because he couldn't drive, of course. But boy, I tell you what, he would stick it to a congregation. He says, "Who have you fed this week?" He was adamant that the answer to all of the issues of homelessness and poverty and hunger could be solved by the churches if they wanted to. And I think he's absolutely right. We keep pointing our fingers at the government and politicians, and it's not their job. Jesus didn't say, "Hey, governors, go out and pass laws." He said to the Christians who were following him, "Go feed the hungry."
I know where a field is right now. It's got turnips and greens, and the man's begging people come take. Mr. Bernie's got behind his back.
All you have to do is get a group of people together, go out there and pick them and take them into the food ministry, and they give them away.
One of the things I like to do when I'm on the road, I'm serious, it's a good little thing we could all do. You can go get a coupon at McDonald's or Burger King. If you see a homeless person, I was always worried about giving them money because I know what they're going to do with it.
Yeah.
Not all of them, 9 times out of 10.
Yeah.
Give them a coupon.
Yeah.
Give them $5.
Buy a $5 gift card. Yeah, exactly. We used to do that.
I got turned down one time.
We used to do that in the church offices, keep those for people who called and said they were hungry, just give them a $5 gift card to the nearest fast food restaurant.
Oh, my God, looks like it's 14 missed calls back there. Is that all these people?
Most of those are 800 numbers. They're people calling to sell the stuff.
That call we got a while ago was from Liberty University. I'm sure they had somebody.
But, I mean, those are the kinds of things that a cutting-edge church, I'm not surprised what you said, because that's what people think of as cutting-edge. No, it's the newest technology. It's the latest fad. It's the whatever.
Well, that's what most people think is cutting-edge.
You're right.
I don't know where I consider it.
But,
I don't.
But, you know, the issue, I think, for the church, and I think particularly for churches whose number one concern is growth, I think if they would look harder at what they don't do, I think they would find the answer to their growth issue. Because, you know, a church that feeds the hungry and clothes the naked and takes care of their neighbor, they're visible. And when you're visible, people show up. And when you're doing things to help other people, people want to become a part of that.
How many people could you feed with the Crystal Cathedral money?
Yeah, well, let's not go there. But yeah, a lot of, and again, we're a rural congregation, so it changes our dynamics some. But, you know, downtown churches that particularly don't have, you know, the affluent white neighborhood they used to have, most of them are finding that their new calling is to be the soup kitchen.
Soup kitchen, yeah.
To be the one who takes care of the homeless, the hungry, the poor, running a free medical clinic, doing those kinds of things. And you know what? People show up. Not only the ones who need the help, but the ones who want to help. There are lots of people in the world out there who would like to go do something for their neighbor. They need somebody to show them how. Kind of like how to plant a garden. They need somebody to show them how.
The trouble this day and time, though, if you let somebody come on your property to pick beans or whatever, and they stump their toe, they're going to see you for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are those issues. Unfortunate, but true.
But yeah, you reminded me of something. You said we don't teach people how to grow a garden. When I was about 14 or 15 years old, my granddaddy couldn't believe I didn't know how to count lumber coming across the bell at the sawmill. What are they teaching you in school? And I couldn't answer that question.
Yeah. Well,
I know what they were teaching me was that.
Well, you know, and every generation can do that. I mean, how many of you learned by the time you graduated from high school could count change for anything that somebody gave you?
Oh,
I mean, I grew up in a restaurant, but I also had an 8th grade math teacher who taught that for like 4 weeks. He taught that. And it's like, by the time he got done with you, if you couldn't count change, you didn't pass. Well, now you've all heard the stories about today. The cash register goofs up. And I've even heard stories where someone says, you know, my bill's $5.25. Here's a 20 and a quarter. You give me $15 back. And the teenager, of course, is in tears because they've never been taught how to deal with that. And so they call the manager over, and the manager can't do it either. We're in the second generation of that. But, I mean, that's really neither here nor there. I mean, every generation has had something lost that the generation before thought they should have known. And whether it was, you know, how to count lumber, or whether it was how to count change, whether it was how to you know, go out and plant a garden. I have fun watching the kids up at East Rowan High School when I drive a school bus up there. They have their own tractor. And the ag class goes out there, and the instructor stands on the step and teaches them how to drive a tractor. Now, tractor's the first thing I learned. Other than the lawnmower, tractor's the first thing I learned how to drive. You know, it's like, go out there in the field, drop the disc, and go. I learned how to do that when I was really young. But, I mean, it's fun watching them do it, because you know what? That dozen kids will be the only ones who graduate from the high school who know how to drive a tractor.
Yeah, but you know what? What you're talking about, that happens more in rural areas, in the cities.
Oh, yeah.
In the big cities, you know, Charlotte, yeah. New York, L.A.,
Boston. Yeah,
Pittsburgh.
There wouldn't
be a need for that.
Oh, yeah.
I have no idea.
Well, my son's a graduate of a Charlotte high school. He can't drive a tractor. But, you know, I didn't have one to show him how to drive either.
Right.
You know? So,
well, there's a big homeless shelter in Charlotte.
Yeah.
That could easily be supported.
You know who started that?
Tony Marciano.
That's not
Tony Marciano.
It's not a name I remember. The churches of Charlotte came up with the idea. George Shedd funded the original one.
Well, Tony Marciano has one right now. He's doing both men and...
This is one that started 25 years ago.
Woman.
25 years ago, it was the churches in Charlotte who started the shelter.
Yeah.
And the way they did it, they only had a small building. George Shedd gave them access to a small building he wasn't using. I think it's where King's College used to be. Anyway, but he gave them this small building to use. They could only house like 50 people. And so what they did with the extras, especially on really cold nights, is they would take the cleanest, safest, most trusted of the homeless, and they would take them to churches. And we had a group of like three churches. We had 12 mattresses. And whichever church was hosting that night, you'd lay the 12 mattresses out, and those people would come in, you'd feed them dinner, and bed them down for the night, feed them breakfast the next morning, and give them a bag lunch, and they'd go off. And one of the key things was that the church that they were staying in needed to be near a bus stop, because most of them, or many of them, had some sort of day labor that they were doing, but they weren't making anywhere near enough money to make a down payment on a house or a power bill or any of those things. So they had some money, but they were homeless. They couldn't even afford a car. But, you know, that was, we started, you know, Room at the Inn started at least 25 years ago. We were doing that. But George Shin was a big part of starting that. I don't know who's running now, because George Shin got ran out of town.
No, Tony Marchion. I don't know what happened to that one. I don't think around.
We're on Room at the Inn still going. I know a couple of churches are still going.
They didn't
want
to
go.
They didn't want to come out here. I knew
George Shin.
You have to have presentation.
That's
why they didn't.
We're too rural for things like that.
Well, I'm working with the soup kitchen over in Concord there. I do it on Thursdays. I'm playing the band, and there's probably a good 50 or 60 people that come in to have soup, or, you know, food. Rather. Yeah. And there's probably a good 20 people that do all the volunteering, cooking, or whatever it is that they do.
And it's and getting, you're right, getting people out here probably is not going to happen real easily, unless we had a bus and we went and got them.
Well, a lot of people get bussed into that church.
But there are places who do soup kitchens, who volunteers come in and rotate doing the meals. That's the way Community Table works in Albemarle, is that all the meals are provided by not just churches, but even some businesses. The nursing home staff goes down about once every other month and does a meal. But you know, they provide the place, and there's even a kitchen if you want to cook there, but groups volunteer to come in and bring the meals. So you don't have to get them here, you just go there. There are opportunities like that. Now, I will admit, I'm not up on what's happening in Cabarrus County.
Well, I do know in Concord that do the homeless and all that and do churches right
there. But there's a variety of places that do meals and things. And,
how many senior citizens come to here every month on Tuesdays?
It varies, but anywhere from 12 to 20.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, anywhere from 12 to 20.
Oh, they all move.
Heck, I love you.
The one that has the most difficulty is Elizabeth. Elizabeth Barry. But she manages okay, because either her daughter or her son brings her, and they pull right down to the door, let her out on the concrete, and she comes right on in. She's probably the least mobile of the ones who come, but she manages just fine. But yeah, it depends. I mean, we had one day, I bet we had 25 or 30 down there. But they weren't all seniors either. That was the July seems to be the month when all of the grandkids visit, and they all come to bingo. So we must have had a dozen kids that day, including my three grandchildren. So, but yeah, typically there's a dozen, 15. Sometimes
I'm over the love
of
them, and I ain't going.
Over the love of them. You don't consider yourself a senior.
Now, let me tell you a little story about the seniors. And this fits right in here. One of the things that we talked about and we decided to do this year was at the September bingo, at the senior day when we played bingo, we decided to give each of them a ticket to the fish fry. There were two or three of them who might have gone. There were a couple whom they made sure meals got taken to because they knew they didn't have their own transportation. Barrett, we decided that we were just going to give all of them. And we had some funds that we used to do that. We gave every one of the seniors their own tickets to the fish fry. And I saw one there, and I can't think of her name. She's not a member of this congregation, but she comes. Is it Martha? Real tall, short hair.
Wasn't sure.
No. Anyway, but she was there, and I told her how glad I was to see her. She says, "You know, I've never come before." She had never been to the fish fry, but because she had a ticket, she came.
Well, and they helped two organizations. It helped the church people.
Yeah.
And it also went into a good cause.
Yeah, all the money went to the Mount Pleasant Food Ministry. But yeah, it helped some of those seniors who wouldn't have gone otherwise. And like a couple of them, we gave two tickets to because we knew they had to have somebody drive. Mm-hmm. So they had a ticket for the driver. So they could say, hey, let's go to the fish fry. I got tickets. And, you know, I think it was the best $200 we ever spent. Giving them those tickets.
Karen and I. Janet said, she said, I got 10. Let's get them. We're modeling.
Karen and I were sitting with a guy. Karen and I were sitting with a guy at the fish fry from the Methodist Church here in Mount Pleasant. He was telling us about his experience. They sent a delegation down to Haiti, and incredible what he said.
Sure.
They were there for 2 weeks. You could not believe. I couldn't explain it, bad as it was.
Oh yeah, and you don't have to go that far. You don't have to go that far.
You got a war forward Concord.
Yeah. I mean, and mission trips is a whole nother issue. It's not that mission trips are bad, but there are an awful lot of churches, I think, that use them as vacation excuses to go somewhere they wanted to go anyway.
Haiti?
Well, I've been on a few mission trips, and I worked doggone hard when I was
young. Oh, I agree with you. But I've heard some mission trip stories that had a little more.
We go out and eat, too.
Yeah. I've heard some mission trip stories that had a little more playtime building. But you don't have to go outside of the continental 48 states in order to find good mission fields, people who need help. They're still building houses on the Gulf Coast. They're still rebuilding houses in Florida. They're still rebuilding houses out here at Sanford.
They still are on the Outer Banks.
And the Outer Banks. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to go very far.
Swan's Quarters this summer, after we had worked that, did three or four roofs, I think he said they had 35 more.
And the damage from Christie up along the Mid-Atlantic stakes, I mean, that's going to be several years in repairs. And again,
a couple of decades.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they said after Katrina, it would be a minimum of 10 years, a minimum of 10 years to get most of the housing rebuilt. And you know, we're just hitting that point. And I know people down there still, and they're still working on houses. They're still rebuilding houses. And again, we're talking mostly about people who didn't have insurance or adequate insurance. And we can talk about that, you know, being an issue of poor or illiterate people and all that. And that's not the case at all. It's mostly retired people who had at some point to choose between medicine and food and paying the insurance bill. We have way too much of that. So rebuilding their house, the only way that happens is people go down and volunteer to do it, and they send money to buy materials with. We've been lucky. We haven't had, since Sandy, that's the only major hurricane we've had in the last few years.
Well, how are we going to improve our workforce, our young people, our work ethic? You know, we're not holding people accountable. We're exposing,
they learn by
expounding lies. You know, this is going to continue. The government, we can't continue on the path to our own.
Can't get them to come to church. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they learn by example.
Look at this congregation.
Look at the people who think Bernie Madoff was a really smart guy until he got caught.
No.
I mean, we lead by example. Those people, I mean, I'm with those in the government who say those who caused all of that crisis, all of them need to go to jail. Now, the problem is that a lot of them didn't do stuff that was outwardly traceable to the point where you can put them in jail. But yet they're still working on it. I mean, I think this big fight against Bank of America was a really good start because, you know, evidence
is... Bank of America's paying the fine.
Well, you know a little secret? The Bank of America's customers ought to pay the fine.
Yes.
Because they're the ones...
They benefited from the profits.
They benefited from the profits. And they're the ones who elect the people on the board.
Well, most of their assets are in the Cayman Islands.
Well,
And you know what? That's one of the reasons I don't bank with one of those people.
Well, I can tell you a personal story. I used to be a Wells Fargo guy, you know, and I bought it. I bought, spent $5,000 and I sold it for less than $500. So, I mean, I'm really...
You waited too long. The more you going to win than how.
But, I mean...
Better that now, I'm just ready.
But again...
Dang it, that's the wrong way. I was just mistaught.
But you know, that is the issue, is that, you know, these young people learn by the examples they see. And who is it the news talks about? Talks about the ones who got caught, but in talking about them, they're like, hey, you know, if I could do that and not get caught.
The drug dealers, well,
and
Hollywood.
And does that have to do with them not coming to church?
Well, exactly. It is. It's the,
I'm serious.
It's
you worry about things like that.
They're taught by example. They're taught by example. Do their parents go to church?
President of the United States.
We're in the...
I don't even want to talk about it.
We are entering the third generation of unchurched in this country. The third generation.
Oh, yeah.
The first generation quit coming in the 60s.
Quit what?
Quit coming in the 60s. The church was part of the establishment, and so they quit coming. And then their children, a lot of them, either didn't go to church or only went briefly. And so now we are in at least the third generation of those who don't know what it is to be in the church, who don't have parents who were ever in the church. And so, lead by example. It's the same thing. If their parents didn't go, and then they don't go. And I talked to I had a heartbreaking talk with a grandmother the other day, who was just scared to death because her grandchildren don't go to church.
I know.
And I said, Grandma, go get your grandkids and take them to church. Well, their parents don't go. I said, forget their parents, take the kids. You don't have, you said, you may have already lost your chance to get the kids to go to church, but the grandkids, you can still say, hey, come spend the Saturday night at Grandma's house, and we'll go to church Sunday morning, and we'll go out for pancakes afterwards or something. You can still do that. But it's going to take the generation of those who do go to church to bring those who aren't coming. Now, you can talk about evangelism in any way, shape, or form that you want.
Yeah.
But the reality is this. If you don't invite people to church, they're not going to come.
That's right.
I can invite all the people I want. They're going to say, well, you're the pastor. That's your job. If you invite them, especially people that you know who trust you, and you not just invite them, but say, here's why I go to church. Here's... And you've heard me say this in sermon after sermon. This is the God I know. And this is the God we go to hear about. Come and see. You do that, and then we as a church do more that's visible to the community, and there won't be a problem with churches growing. But the problem is we're complacent. We're
satisfied, like we're talking about.
Yeah.
We all went to church growing up. They'll all come back. We just sit here and wait for them, and they'll show up at our doors. Well, it ain't going to happen. Mm-mm.
And this is the only.
But it goes back to teaching by example, leading by example, showing by example. Show them why you come to church. I mean, you can't just tell somebody to come to church, but give them a reason. Why is it you come? What is it you get here? And if it's just because you get to sit in your favorite pew and sing your favorite hymns, I'm sorry, that's not going to convince anybody. But if you come because there's something here that brings you back week after week, then you can tell that to somebody. They'll come. They'll try it.
But the thing is, you're talking about young... I'm saying young people aren't coming to our church.
Yeah.
Yet... The church we were talking about earlier, we were making fun of evolution. They have a lot of young people going to that church. And there's a lot of them going to that church. And they're young people.
But why are they going? Because their parents are going.
I don't care why they're going. Because their parents are going to meet God.
Because their parents are going.
No. I'm talking about young teenagers. Who would never, no.
Most of them don't show up on their own. Somebody takes them.
No. The Evolution Church is a lot of young married. They're 20, 30
yeah,
people.
Young married. People with transportation.
And most of them never went to church before. All of a sudden, they're going to a...
Yes.
Some of it is entertainment,
but they're going to church.
But I also tell you this. You know who showed up with the biggest crew to work on the Lutheran Habitat House? Evolution Church.
Yeah.
They had more people at that than any of the Lutheran churches did.
Well, my sister...
It's a lot bigger.
That has nothing to do with it. Because they make it a priority.
Robert was going to it, and then she started going to it.
I think thousands of people.
I can't get my wife to come to church. Yeah. And she'd go to that Evolution Church.
If you want to see a bunch of them,
and she's a good woman,
they had the whole creation.
There's energy, I guess.
We might have entertainment Sunday. I invited Willie Nelson.
There you go.
Spread that word around.
Willie Nelson, Bob Bird, and Willie Nelson.
Well,
we're in our sign, Pastor.
As long as you know, don't
you lie on our sign, right?
As long as you don't do with that one church in the Revolution.
Yeah. Well, but. Yeah, I think one of the things you said back there about energy in the church, I think that is a key. But energy in the church can be a lot of things, and it can include old people like us just going out and feeding the hungry and being visible in the neighborhood.
You know,
being
that's
visible
probably
in the community.
Only thing this church can do. I mean, we're not going to draw in hundreds and hundreds of people.
We don't put them.
We'll
find a place where we get them.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that as far as what we can do as Mount Gilead congregation is more of like participating in that fish fry Saturday.
Yep.
Well, whether you do that with a contribution more than just your
yep.
fish ticket.
Yep.
Or whether you go there and fry yep. fish. Ain't nobody going to ask me to fry fish.
Yeah.
Probably won't eat it if I do, but there's a...
Fred can teach you.
Well, I don't know if Fred can teach me how to fry fish like he does. That's a talent.
But, you know, but you're right. There are things that we could do. There are things that we could do that would be visible in the community. And people would come say, who are those people? And they'd come out here. Some of them would come out here and find out. And there are people who are in this neighborhood around us who know where we are, but have never had a good reason to come here.
They didn't know where the contribution for the
money was going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they have another one this coming weekend that the money is going to go to the food pantry in Mount Pleasant.
Who is? The trail ride, yeah.
I don't think I can do that anymore.
That's where Roger's Sunday School class in the Methodist Church is.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are past our time.
Did we get off of Revelation?
No, it's actually all very relevant to what we were talking about. So it's a good conversation. Let us close in prayer. O God of history, help us to hear your word for us today. Calm our fears, awaken us from our apathy, and give us courage to be your people in a world that doesn't always honor your name. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.